The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
It was very vague. It was not determined when exactly the Boundary Commission would meet. Although it came into being, the structures of Northern Ireland were uncertain.
The beginning of the border, how Ireland's northern frontier was initially established in the early 1920s.
There's no guerrilla warfare here. It's out in the open, same as 1916.
They've got a force of about 100 men or thereabouts armed up, but they occupy Baileak and they occupy Bedecal.
We'll also hear about a battle that took place on the Donegal-Fermanagh border just before the Civil War. Plus...
The only ambush that we had in Rathlein, the parish of Rathlein, the town of Leinsborough, would have been called the Turlough Ambush.
Stories from the Irish War of Independence in Longford.
He led the Clonfin ambush, which was a major, major engagement for the North Longford Flying Column.
Remember in Kilmichael, you see, I said, gentlemen, open your tunics and throw out the small 380 Webley that you have in your inside tunic pocket, and they all threw them out.
We'll hear about Sean McKeown and his storied career during the conflict. But to begin this evening... 100 years ago today, the Government of Ireland Act was passed by the British Parliament. Also known as the Fourth Home Rule Bill, the Act was the first step towards partition and the ultimate exclusion of the six counties in the north from an independent Irish state. We're going to hear now some detail on the early history of the Northern Ireland border. This report from Mark McMenamin outlines how this act ultimately culminated in the largest military engagement between the IRA and British forces in Ireland since 1916, a confrontation known as the Battle of Pettigo and Baileak.
From 1912 onwards, it became clear by many politicians and observers that something had to be done about Ulster.
That's historian Cormac Moore, author of the book Birth of the Border, The Impact of Partition in Ireland.
A number of schemes were suggested, such as allowing certain counties or all of Ulster remaining within Westminster. Some were looking for temporary exclusion of some Ulster counties, some were looking for permanent exclusion. But it was the Government of Ireland Act of 1920 which led to the partition of Ireland.
While initially suggesting a nine-county state, Northern Ireland eventually came into being later that year as a six-county state.
In the summer of 1921, before a truce was signed with Sinn Féin. And although it came into being, the structures of Northern Ireland were uncertain. And even as an entity, it probably would have survived anyway, but it may not have survived in the form it did. Lloyd George, a very slippery character, was open to different solutions as long as he got a deal with Sinn Féin.
When the border was eventually decided, it left many territories in either state that straddled the border undecided.
So Lloyd George decided to offer a boundary commission to Sinn Féin, and this became Article 12.
Article 12 of the 1921 Anglo-Irish Treaty stated that Northern Ireland could opt out of the Irish Free State and provided for a commission to establish a permanent frontier.
Now, what the Boundary Commission stated was that the border of Ireland would be decided at a future date in line with inhabitants' wishes and also dependent on geographic and economic needs. So it was very vague. It was not determined when exactly the Boundary Commission would meet. No plebiscite was asked for or no plebiscite was given. So it really was a very poor move by Sinn Féin.
I travelled to Pettigo in County Donegal, a town which itself is bisected by the Irish border, to meet local historian Brian Drummond.
We're in Pettigo, we're on the bridge, and you're in Northern Ireland, and I'm in the Republic of Ireland. And I suppose we're talking about Pettigo and, I suppose, the Battle of Baileak.
In 1922, a battle broke out between the IRA and the B-Specials and British reinforcements over the disputed territories on the Donegal-Fermanagh border.
In May, going into June, there's a battle. And it's the first time since 1916, if you consider that the campaign for Irish independence was very much a guerrilla campaign, this is now soldiers on the ground, so to speak. And you've got the first time since 1916 where the IRA are actually out in the open and they're fighting a force. And in this area, running from kind of Ballyshannon, Bundoran, up to Baileak, up to Pettigo, you've got the Irish National Army, you've got the IRA, you've got pro-treaty and anti-treaty, but that's not really even settled down yet. And they've got a force of about 100 men or thereabouts armed up, small arms and all the rest of it. But they occupy Baleek and they occupy Bedico, which is essentially going to be part of Northern Ireland and eventually does end up as part of Northern Ireland.
The incident became a cause célèbre in London newspapers.
It starts getting reported back into newspapers in London. And where Lloyd George wants to kind of ignore it as being sort of, this is just like a little border thing and whatever, and it will go away. And it did actually go away. A guy called Winston Churchill takes a different view.
Eventually, Winston Churchill committed a group of British Army personnel to quell the battle, effectively imposing British rule on the contested areas.
And he, in the latter stages of the conflict, commits a substantial force of British troops to go and take the area, so to speak. There's 1,500 regulars involved. There's artillery, there's armoured cars, and eventually even there's fighter aircraft who are flying over the area to ensure that they are holding ground, so to speak.
The IRA had lost the Irish territory it had been protecting.
They lost the ground, they lost Baleek, they lost Pedico. And it's also interesting because it's in current terms, it's also fake news. This is not really a battle. This is more kind of a shooting match across the border, what's going to become the border in later stages.
In many ways, the Battle of Pedico set the tone for future years in relation to contested border areas.
And you have these reports in the London Times and other papers about this huge conflict and huge casualty, whatever, but it isn't. But it becomes a political cause célèbre, and Churchill makes great play on it. And again, if you go online and the Pathé News website, I think on YouTube, you will find the British restaged the battle for cameras. And you can also get photographs online where, you know, guys standing across the wall fighting the rebels, all this sort of stuff, whatever. But what happened in the political sense was very significant, but it was based on a myth. A myth, and it's like many things in Irish history, like, you know, how great was the Battle of Baleek?
Mark McMenamin was reporting there on the Battle of Pedico and Baleek in 1922 and the events leading up to that battle. And Mark McMenamin, who's a Donegal native, joins me now. Mark, first of all, tell us more about the towns themselves, about Baleek and Pedico. Where exactly are they?
Well, Baleek and Pedico are two quite unusual places, especially to anybody that hasn't been there themselves. Now, I'm from Ballyshannon originally, so they're very close to me in South Donegal. They run along the Donegal Fermanagh border, but they're peculiar in that the border comes straight into these towns. In the case of Pedico, it bisects the town itself using the Termon River as the marking point. So essentially you have a situation where the two streets in the town, the main street is in Donegal, and the High Street, as they call it, is in County Fermanagh. So it literally bisects the border. In terms of Baleek, a very strange situation where it kind of straddles along the River Erne, and you have a high point in the town called the Battery or Baleek Fort, which is in the south, and then the main street of the town runs up in the north. And I suppose these two places are kind of indicative of the Battle of Baleek and the Battle of Pedico as they come to be known, because you have to imagine that in this time, coming up after the Government of Ireland Act, this is disputed territory. Nobody really knows, you know, there's a nationalist perception, a Sinn Féin perception, that this is southern land and then northern land on the unionist side, and both sides are willing to reinforce that assumption through force of arms if necessary.
And were people actually killed in the Battle of Pedico and Baleek?
Well, the Battle of Pedico and Baleek itself is kind of an unusual kind of a thing. First and foremost, it's the first time since 1916 that there are IRA men out actually fighting a war. There's no guerrilla warfare here. It's out in the open, same as 1916. It's also the first time that the British use artillery against Irish men since 1916 as well. And there's roughly a force of 100 IRA men. And initially, there's a group of Ulster Special Constabulary men, and what we've gone then to be B Specials and C Specials, which are led by Lord Brookborough. And there's fighting to and fro. And ultimately, there's four IRA men killed. Two of them from Tyrone and two of them from elsewhere. Now, there's no real indication of the British casualties because the whole thing becomes a cause célèbre in London, particularly in the London newspapers, where they make the whole thing out to be this incredible battle, when in reality, it really wasn't as severe. But what you do have is 100 or so IRA men, mostly from counties Tyrone. A lot of them weren't even local. Some of them actually were from even from Cork and Kerry that had retreated from the Northern campaign. And they're holding off a substantial force of beef specials and reserves. Ultimately, Churchill sends in a much larger force of the British Army to, you know, to really hammer home British rule in this area. Artillery, they send in more infantry men, and they even send in air support, you know, to make sure that they're taking these areas. Churchill makes great play on it. It's amped up big time in the British newspapers, but ultimately, four deaths on the Republican side.
Now, tell us a bit more about the news footage. You mentioned news footage in the report. Tell us a little bit more about that news footage, if you would.
There's some fantastic film footage off this, and you can check that out on the Irish Film Archive. So the Irish Film Institute have the Irish Independence Film Collection, which is available online. And you can actually watch some footage off the Battle of Pedigo and the Battle of Bleak. The thing is, though, it's not actually footage off the Battle of Bleak. It's restaged. So the British have actually restaged the battle for the cameras. So it's an early example of fake news. They've restaged it for propaganda purposes. And the Fleet Street newspapers make great play on this. And, you know, in these old silent films, there are title cards, which, you know, they preempt the action in each scene. Some of them are like, you know, the troops have the Sinn Féiners on the run, you know, and we're ridding the town of the rebels and all that. But there's no rebels in sight. It's just the British kind of firing artillery into a already deserted town. But it goes on to be shown all across the empire. And it's part of, I suppose, Churchill's role as the secretary for the colonies to hammer home this sort of propaganda that they're administering British rule in Ireland and these contested areas will no longer be contested, so to speak.
Now, we heard also in the report about an initial idea of a 9-county northern state. Why was that considered, and was the idea ever really a runner?
Well, the initial idea, Lloyd George was determined to try and solve this issue, to solve the Ulster question, and he wanted to be the man that was going to solve it. Initially, what the Government of Ireland is it's an early attempt at federalism, you know, to bring the federalist model to Ireland and to give autonomy to Ulster. So initially, you know, the Ulster Unionists, they just wanted to be directly ruled by Westminster, but then they gradually saw it to be more advantageous to have their own devolved government because they could do what they wanted. And essentially, that's what they did in later years. Initially, they thought of a 9-county state and just to have one parliament in Dublin that would look after Munster, Connacht and Leinster. And then to have a 9-county parliament in Stormont looking after Ulster. But obviously, that wasn't going to work with the demographics. And I come from Donegal, and you know, there's a substantial Protestant community in Donegal. Even to this day, we have the only Orange Parade in the Republic of Ireland, is not too far where I'm from, in Rosnaula, every year. So there is that element there. But it wasn't going to work because of the demographics. Counties like Donegal, Cavan, Monaghan would have ensured that there was would have been essentially a slim Catholic majority. So it was never going to work. So an artificial majority for unionists had to be created. And thus the 6-county state became what it was and is there still to this day.
Now, of course, there was some doubt about what exactly the 6 counties was going to be. So talk to us a bit more about the Boundary Commission and how did the Irish government fare in their negotiations when it came to the drawing up of a border, a new border?
Well, the initial, I suppose, perception of the Irish government was that the border is there with the Government of Ireland Act in 1920. There's going to be a boundary commission, and they had hoped that they were going to get huge swathes of land. You know, that they were hoping to get Derry City, for example, huge parts of Armagh, Fermanagh, Tyrone. And it was quite a kind of a boozy assumption that they were going to, you know, get all these areas. And that's not the case. Obviously, then the Civil War happens down here, and it's a huge drawback in terms of this. Eventually, when there's a report published, then the first report is kind of leaked, you know, of what the Boundary Commission is going to determine. It's a lot less than they had ambitions for, the Irish government had. And you're looking at kind of actually situations where the Irish Free State is going to cede land to the Northern Ireland state. They look for that to be scrapped and to revert back to the Government of Ireland Act with the 6-county state and to maintain that status quo, which remains to this day.
Mark McMenamin, many thanks for joining us this evening to talk about the Battle of Bleak and Pedigo and the early history of the Northern Ireland border. After the break, we'll explore more local history of the Irish War of Independence and we'll be visiting County Longford. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. Now, if you're a regular listener to the programme, you'll have heard our War of Independence series last year, where over the course of 10 episodes, we explored various aspects of that conflict, from the opening shots of the war to the experience of women, and of course subjects like the Black and Tans, the Auxiliaries, Michael Collins's intelligence operation, and many more besides. But we're not finished yet, of course, and as the decade of centenaries rolls on, we'll continue to explore the events of the years 1919 to 21 and how the war played out in various counties, towns and parishes around Ireland. For the rest of the programme this evening, we're going to be focusing on Longford. Now, recently, our producer, Lorcan Clancy, visited Lanesborough in the south of that county to discover some of the local stories from the period that took place in one small town.
About a month ago, I was at Lanesborough Branch Library on the main street in the town. I went to meet local historian John Casey.
I had a butcher shop for over 50 years, and when the pensioners would come in on a Friday, they'd tell me the stories about the Black and Tans. The business went back to 1860, which was started by my great-grandfather, but I had always a great interest in local history.
John is the custodian of the history of the town and has collected many a tale.
I'd have reams and reams of local history.
A lot of his stories take place during the War of Independence years.
My mother, when she worked in a draper shop next door during the War of Independence, and she went for a walk with some of her friends, and she wore a red coat along by the Larrie, and there was cattle in the field where they walked, and there was a bull. And did you ever hear tell of a red rag to a bull? The bull charger, the red coat. And there was a young Black and Tan walking his terrier dog along by the shore, and he set the terrier dog on the bull, and the bull changed direction. I thought that was a nice little story.
Every town has a local historian like John Casey, someone who collects local stories and local folklore.
All of the stories recorded were taken about when I was a child, and when the time went by, I got more interested.
He has one great story about a tailor's apprentice working on the main street in Lanesborough who had a run-in with the Black and Tans.
The tailor's house, the tailor's business, was a rambling house. People used to play cards. So the Black and Tans used to come in and play cards too. And people might say, Lord, what? That was shocking. But what could they do? They had the guns. But they come in and play the cards with the local people. And they take off their guns and leave them on the table. There was an apprentice tailor, and he was fascinated with the guns. So the young Black and Tan was showing him how it worked. And the tailor took up the gun anyway, and he shot the young Black and Tan, not intentionally now, it was an accident, shot him stone dead. So he was transported down to the barracks, which was only a few doors away down. And as a result of the head constable Gleeson, who was a very fair policeman, the young tailor was released. He was, later he was supposed to have been in the IRA, but I don't think he was. But even so, he got a pension as a result of shooting the Black and Tan.
John finds stories like this in the pages of old editions of the Longford Leader newspaper.
After the 1916 rebellion, as a result of the rebellion, Michael Collins set up the volunteers all over Ireland, and Lanesborough was no exception. 40 or 50 young men decided to join, but they would have no arms or anything like that, or very little anyway. We're South Longford, so the volunteers in South Longford, especially in my area, they were badly supplied with ammunition. They had very little, but they had a small amount.
Sourcing arms and ammunition was a constant problem for the IRA all over the country during the War of Independence.
But North Longford was a different kettle of fish altogether. They were very well armed and carried out lots of ambushes and was able to secure military equipment from some of the soldiers that were stationed in Longford barracks, give them a few pounds, and they threw the rifles out across the wall.
North Longford, the domain of Sean McKeown, was a more active theatre during the conflict.
General Sean McKeown, he wasn't a general then, of course, at that stage, but he was a very outstanding leader, equal to Michael Collins, and he was a very good friend of Michael Collins as well. Michael Collins was at his wedding in Longford eventually when the War of Independence was almost over, but not entirely over, and he carried out most of the ambushes.
including the only ambush that we had in Racline, the parish of Racline, the town of Lanesborough, would have been called the Turlow Ambush.
This ambush on a party of black and tans was carried out by the North Longford unit, but local men would have provided the intelligence that led to the ambush.
The Turlow Ambush is halfway between Lanesborough and Newtown Cashel. One of the black and tans was shot dead, and the rest of the black and tans scattered. We called them black and tans, but he was a police constable. That was the official name for them, a police constable, Kenton, and he was shot in the Turlow Ambush. His remains were conveyed to England for internment and were awarded a military funeral.
The black and tans, who had scattered and escaped, disposed of their jackets to avoid being recognised and killed by snipers.
And their undergarments was grey, same colour as the walls, and they escaped back to Lanesborough.
One of these jackets was found in a garden with a letter in the pocket,
where the black and tan was writing to his wife in England, stating that hopefully that he'll see her soon, hopefully, if he survives this conflict, and hope she bought the linoleum for the back kitchen and that the baby is okay, and I'll see you if everything goes according to plan. The black and tans, in a rage of revenge at the death of one of their comrades, ordered 12 of the most prominent men on the main street to line up against the barracks wall, proposing to shoot them. But there was a doubt that they would carry it out anyway. The head constable Gleeson walked up between the black and tans and the condemned men and said, "If you will have to shoot me first." The black and tans relented, and head constable Gleeson ordered the black and tans out of Lanesborough. They shot the chimney pots of the barracks in anger. Head constable Gleeson resigned from the RIC in protest at the behaviour of the Crown Forces in Ireland.
Lorcan Clancy was reporting there from Lanesborough, County Longford, and he was talking to local historian John Casey about what went on in that town during the Irish War of Independence. And we're staying in Longford because we're going to spend the rest of the programme looking at the career of Sean McKeown, who was the most prominent leader in the county and commandant of the North Longford Flying Column. Our researcher Liz Gillis has been trawling through RTE archives and uncovering interviews that McKeown gave in the 1960s, where he details his own role in the conflict. The first clip we're going to hear is McKeown talking about the circumstances leading to his arrest in 1919.
I took an active part in the establishment of the committee that collected the Dáil loan locally, and we put up posters asking you to subscribe. I put up this poster, and as I was putting it up, this RIC sergeant came along and proceeded to take it down. I stopped him, and the net result of that was he challenged me for my name. I told him to buzz off, and he said, "I know your name." And I said, "Well, if you do, why do you ask it?" So that was the end of that. The poster remained up. And after about 3 weeks, my home was surrounded. I was brought a prisoner to Longford and sentenced to 2 months in Sligo Jail. I spent Christmas of 1919 in Sligo Jail. I was then released on the 28th or 29th of December, and I was attacking Drumlish Barracks on the 6th of January.
The voice there of Sean McKeown on promoting the Dáil loan and his arrest and imprisonment in late 1919. I'm joined now by historian and author Liz Gillis, who'll tell us more about McKeown, who was known as the Blacksmith of Ballinalee. Liz, let's actually start with that nickname, the Blacksmith of Ballinalee. How did Sean McKeown acquire it?
Well, his father was a blacksmith, and he had his own forge in Ballinalee, and Sean and his brother, they followed in his father's footsteps, basically, and they took over the run of the forge when his father died. So hence the name. He was a blacksmith from Ballinalee, and that's where the nickname came from.
Tell us a bit more about his background. He was a Republican, I think, from a very young age.
He was, like a lot of young men at that time that were born in the 1890s, he was very influenced by local people, telling them about the Republican revolutionary organisations that had been around, you know, and that had a deep, deep influence on him from a very young age, and it stuck with him. He was involved with the United Irish League when he was quite young, and as soon as the volunteers were set up, he joined it very early on in 1914. It was actually the Clonbrony Company of the volunteers that he joined, that would have been associated with his village of Ballinalee. And he rises, or he rose very quickly through the ranks. He became a second lieutenant in a very short time. And then in late 1914, he continues his involvement with the Republican movement. He joined the Granard Circle of the IRB. So you can see it's a natural progression for him. He's hearing the stories from a young age. It sticks with him. The volunteers are set up, he joins, and then that goes hand in hand with him joining the IRB, which he continued to be involved in right throughout his career.
Now, at the time of his arrest in December 1919, the War of Independence had been going on for almost a year at that stage. But it had mainly involved IRA shooting policemen on patrol, or in the case of Dublin, G-men, the political detectives, the political wing, if you like, of the Dublin Metropolitan Police. McKeown talks about attacking an RIC barracks. Tell us how that came about.
Yeah, you had the build-up really with the attacks on the RAC patrols and so on. But you then had in early 1920, GHQ in Dublin actually sanctioned the attacks of RAC barracks. So they're asserting their control over the IRA. And this is a way to step up the campaign. Also, it was a way of getting weapons, which the IRA were always short of. But you can see that by doing this, it would make it a nationwide campaign. And also it made sense because they sought to attack the barracks, the smaller barracks at first. And then if they destroyed those barracks, that removed the local RIC from all these little towns and villages around the country, because there was loads of barracks in Ireland at that time. And it was very, very successful. Right throughout March, you see a lot of barracks being evacuated and the RIC withdrawn to the larger towns, which meant that the IRA then were pretty much in control of the countryside.
And as we hear, though, from McKeown, the first attack in Longford was not that successful.
We solemnly surrounded the place, blocked the roads far and wide. It was well planned from that we couldn't be surprised. But of course there was several then parties blocking the roads from Longford to Drumleesh, from Mohill to Drumleesh, from Ballinalee to Drumleesh. But we put a mine under the gable of the barracks containing 60 sticks of gelignite, and we had an exploder. And we withdrew then about 30 yards. And thank God it didn't go off. The attack went on the whole night. There were both police and military in the barracks. It was a fairly strong post.
So Liz, he, as he says there, he attempted to detonate 60 sticks of gelignite. Now that sounds like a lot. Had it gone off, would his story and the story of lots of other people have ended right there?
Pretty much. McKeown talks about what happened after the attack. Now, the reason the 60 sticks of gelignite didn't go off is because it was frozen, and luckily enough for them. So they withdrew, they retrieved gelignite and they dried it out, and they decided they'd try 2 sticks, which they did. And that caused major damage. And at that point, they realised they were lucky that the 60 sticks didn't go off, because I think they pretty much would have taken out everything, including themselves.
I'm thinking of Clerkenwell Prison and the attempt, the escape attempt in Clerkenwell in the 1860s, and of a similar nature, far, far too much explosive used. Now, McKeown himself, what was his position in the IRA round about that time?
By that time, he had been appointed commandant of the 1st Battalion of the Longford Brigade. So you can see that he continued to rise through the ranks very, very quickly. He was obviously, he had proven himself as a capable leader to be promoted to the man in charge, pretty much, of his own battalion.
And how quick was the IRA in Longford, how quick was McKeown to learn from that first experience?
They did react very quickly to their previous engagements. If you look at the attacks that follow, you had on the 10th of June, he led the attack on Ballinamuck Barracks. Now, that was completely destroyed. And then that was followed in July by a raid on the guard room in Longford Military Barracks. So where's previously they were attacking RAC barracks, they actually went into a military barracks, a very heavily fortified structure, and they succeeded in getting rifles and ammunition and grenades and so on, but they didn't let up because that was then followed in August by the attack on Ballymahon barracks. And then you had in September, he led the attack on Arvar barracks, and that was another success. So learning from their first barracks attack, they didn't make the same mistakes.
Okay, we're going to hear from McKeown himself again. Here he's talking about that last attack that Liz mentioned on Arva barracks, which, though successful, was not without its difficulties.
Our first real capture was Arva, in which we captured that after about an hour and a half. We put our post down silently, you see. Then the attacking party pushed up as closely as they could. And in Arva, case you broke in through the house next door, broke the roof of the house next door, and there was a laneway between them. The idea was that you'd throw a bomb in on the roof of the barracks. I called on them to surrender after, but that took considerable time to do that particular type of work, to get the roof broken in. But we had a greater task than that. There were six boys in the house that we went into, and I carried all six down, put them safely in a room, and not one of them awoke except one. As I was carrying him down, he woke up and he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm your Uncle Sean."
Liz, that young boy that he mentions there, McKeown recalls talking to, did the young boy himself actually remember that night?
He did, and McKeown talks about meeting him about 40 years later. This grown man now came up to him, and McKeown hadn't a clue who he was, but the man knew who McKeown was because he had been there that night. He was the boy that McKeown carried down the stairs, and he woke up and he greeted him as uncle.
And did his efforts at this stage, did it propel him up the ranks of the IRA in Longford?
It did. McKeown's successes were recognised by his superiors because by September he was appointed Vice Commandant of the Longford Brigade. So he is the second in command. He's the second man in charge of the whole brigade. And then he soon formed the North Longford Flying Column, which he got into action pretty quickly.
Now, we hear a lot about flying columns in relation to the Irish War of Independence. What was the purpose, what was the function and the composition as well, I suppose, of a flying column?
Well, they were sort of formed out of necessity because by mid-1920, a lot of IRA men had to go on the run. So these men couldn't run the risk of going home because they could be arrested or, you know, as it proved, worse could happen to them. So you have these mobile units being set up around the country. They were pretty much full-time volunteers that would be ready to attack at a moment's notice and carry out engagements against the Crown forces. And the North Longford Flying Column was no exception.
Now, by 1921, I think the Crown forces were hot on the heels of McKeown, and he had a very close shave in January of that year. Tell us about that.
Yeah, he was actually lucky to get out by the skin of his teeth, really, because he was a wanted man. They knew who he was because he had been arrested before. But on the 7th of January, he had a meeting with members of the Flying Column in a place called Martin's Cottage. Now, that was a safe house and it was close to Ballinlea. But obviously the authorities got wind of this and they quickly descended on the house, surrounded the house, and then a gunfight broke out. Now, McKeown, luckily enough for him, he managed to escape. But in the fight, you had DI Thomas McGrath and he was shot and killed. And McKeown was actually accused of his murder. Now, that was not proven, but they did levy that charge against McKeown that he was responsible for the murder of DI McGrath.
Okay, so there's no doubt at this stage that McKeown is a wanted man. So did he lie low at this point?
No, he didn't. No. God, less than a month later, on the 2nd of February, he led the Clonfin ambush, which was a major, major engagement for the North Longford Flying Column. It was a hugely successful engagement.
Okay, now the Clonfin ambush in February 1921, as you suggest, perhaps the most famous engagement that took place in Longford. In fact, it's one of the most famous engagements that takes place in the War of Independence in its entirety. So what happened at Clonfin?
Well, it's very similar to the Carmichael ambush that happened the previous November down in West Cork, in that you had 21 members of the North Longford Flying Column attacked two lorries of auxiliaries. They placed a landmine on the road, and the auxiliaries were completely unaware, and they chose Clonfin because it was on the main road between Ballinalee and Granard, I think. The mine went off and that took out completely the first lorry. The driver was killed, everyone inside the lorry was wounded, and then the second lorry followed on pretty quickly, but that was completely surrounded by the remaining volunteers. The gunfight followed, but you had McKeown overseeing this, in which after the auxiliaries ran out of ammunition, they were ordered to surrender. They did, and the column succeeded in taking away a number of weapons and ammunition.
Now let's hear again from McKeown himself, because there was one big difference between Clonfin and Kilmichael, and that's the fact that McKeown let the survivors live.
It was a very tough fight for a certain length of time, and then they surrendered. And remembering Kilmichael, you see, I said, "Gentlemen, open your tunics and throw out the small 380 Webley that you have in your inside tunic pocket," and they all threw them out. Then this auxiliary said, "Our commanding officer wants to speak to you." I said, "Where is he?" So he brought me down, and this very fine looking man was lying on the side of the road. He asked me what I was going to do with his fellas, and I said, "If you reverse the positions, what will you do?" And he said, "My God, is it as bad as that?" And I said, "No, I'm treating you as prisoners of war, and I'm giving you a lorry to take away your wounded." Then he said, "If I send my man away, might I ask your name?" And I said, "There's no necessity to send him away. My name is John McKeown, and I'm the OC." And with that, he died.
The voice there of Sean McKeown talking about the aftermath of the Clonfin ambush. And Liz, he identified himself to the commanding officer of the auxiliaries.
He did, and you've heard it in the clip there. But what was really strange about this in terms of McKeown and what it could mean for him was that he identified himself in front of a witness. The commanding officer had said that, you know, he would send his man away, but McKeown said, no, there's no need to send this man away. I am Sean McKeown. So he was taking charge. He was taking responsibility for what had actually happened at Clonfin.
Now, his luck eventually ran out, Liz. Tell me about the circumstances of his arrest.
Yeah, finally in March, they did get him. Now, he had been called to Dublin. He'd been specifically requested to go to Dublin by Cathal Brua. He was the Minister for Defence. And it was to take part in a special op that was being planned by Cathal Brua, in that he wanted to assassinate members of the British Cabinet. Now, Sean McKeown didn't take part in this, but he made his return to Longford on the train, and the train stopped at Mullingar. There was a number of police, so they got everyone off the train, and McKeown was recognised and arrested there and then. Now, the thing was that he knew that he was a wanted man. He couldn't take a risk. He had to try and make a break for it, which he did, but it didn't go well. He was actually shot at close range in the chest. So what the authorities did was to get him out of Longford as quick as possible. He was transferred to Dublin and then held in Mountjoy Jail, where he was to await his trial.
And what charges were brought against him?
He was charged with the murder of D.I. McGrath in Martin's Cottage in January. So they were determined that he was going to be the one that paid the price for McGrath's murder, and they were the charges that they levied against him.
Now, he had some very unlikely character witnesses testify on his behalf, didn't he?
He did, and this is where Clonfin has a connection with this, and I suppose it shows his chivalry, because three auxiliaries who were at Clonfin, who surrendered, they actually testified in his favour. Now, it didn't do anything, because they were determined that someone was going to pay for the death of McGrath, and it was going to be McKeown. He was found guilty and sentenced to death.
Now, his trial took place in June 1921. That's within a month of the truce. Now, obviously, nobody knew that the truce was going to be declared at that stage, ending the conflict. So no one knew what was going to happen to McKeown. But Collins was determined to get McKeown out of prison, so much so that he planned an escape. Tell us about that.
The IRA had lost some high-ranking people, and the government had been carrying out executions, especially in March and April, and Collins was not going to lose McCown. So you had this whole plan that members of Collins's closest group, so members of the squad and active service unit, would try to break McCown out of Mountjoy. They stole an armoured car from an abattoir on the north side of the city. The driver was Pat McCrae. Now, the driver of the armoured car, he was killed because he wouldn't give up the armoured car, but the IRA succeeded in getting it from the abattoir, and Pat McCrae then drove it to a pre-organised location where he met Emmett Dalton and Joe Leonard. Now, they were dressed as British officers. Emmett Dalton was ex-British Army, so had two Army uniforms laying around. And then they drove in the armoured car to Mountjoy Jail. And the plan was that they would pretend to be officers coming from Dublin Castle to interview McCown. They'd get inside the jail, they'd hold up the guards, and then succeed in getting McCown out, and then he'd be safe.
Now, you could actually do a whole segment on this particular event, but suffice to say it didn't go quite as planned, as we're going to hear now from one of the men involved, mentioned there by Liz, and that's Emmett Dalton.
So I closed the door behind me and I said to the governor and told him that I wanted to read this evidence to McCown, who was a prisoner here, and either I should be allowed to go see him or have him brought here to me. And whilst he's looking at the letter, I took out my revolver and I pointed it at him and I said, "Hands up, gentlemen, please." Apparently it wasn't sufficiently forceful for Joe Leonard, because he said, "Put up your effing hands." And believe me, they did. Leonard says, "What'll I tie them up with?" So I said, "Well, take their handkerchiefs and tie their hands behind their backs. Stand them facing the wall." Now, my intention at this time was, having held them up, to try again get McCown. But unfortunately, the shooting taking place outside had created a state of crisis. And now it's a question of getting out ourselves.
Now, obviously, McCown wasn't sprung in this attempt, but the people behind the operation, did they actually manage to escape?
They did. Very luckily for them, it was thanks to the effectiveness of their uniforms. They got into the armoured car. They drove off very calmly, and they were even followed by a party of soldiers who lined the road leading from Mountjoy, obviously to make sure they wouldn't be attacked, because they actually believed that they were who they said they were, that they were military officers who had come from Dublin Castle to interview the prisoner McCown.
Now, we know that McCown wasn't executed, as obviously he gave that interview in the 1960s, but it wasn't the efforts of Michael Collins or anyone in the Republican movement that saved him. Here, McCown himself tells the story of how he was reprieved.
The death penalty was to be carried out on the 3rd or 4th of July, but a man named Frank Hemming had been sent over by Lloyd George to bring the murderer of Canon Magner to justice. And when he found that he was to carry out the death penalty, he then went across to England. He had private audience with Lloyd George, told Lloyd George what was happening and that if that happened, that the truce is off. He found Lloyd George in the garden playing with a granddaughter. He then told him what was his mission. And in the meantime, the child says, "Daddy, come on and play." And Lloyd George said, "I can't, because I have to decide whether a man will live or die." And the child said, "Daddy, let him live."
And with those words, we know that Sean McCown did indeed live and continued his army career, fighting on the Free State side during the Civil War and later serving as a TD and as a minister for many years. But that's a story for another time. Liz Gillis, thank you very much for talking to us, taking us through the War of Independence career of Sean McCown and those extracts from interviews he gave, which are in the RTE archives. Before we go, we just have to play one more extraordinary recording of Sean McCown, a recording that's held in the military archives. This is one of 12 voice recordings collected by the Bureau of Military History in the early 1950s. Here, McCown is reenacting the address he gave at his own trial in June of 1921.
"Officers and gentlemen of the court-martial, when you opened the proceedings this morning, I told you I was an officer of the Irish Republican Army and claim treatment as an officer. But gentlemen, you are here to try me not as an officer, but as a murderer. And why? just because I took up arms in defence of my native land. Defence of one's native land has ever been a privilege to the peoples of all nations, and all nations have demanded the services of their sons as a right. Be sure that the principle, which is a proper principle for the Yugoslavs, the Czechoslovakians, for the Belgians and the Serbians, is equally a proper principle for the Irish.
The voice there of Sean McKeown recalling the words he read at his own court-martial in 1921. And that recording is courtesy of the military archives. If you're particularly interested in the War of Independence, unfortunately, as you probably know, if you're a regular listener, we had to abandon our Hindsight Festival. But we have a virtual Hindsight Festival involving a lot of material relating to the Irish War of Independence on www.hinterland.ie. If you have any time on your hands and want to spend it in the War of Independence back 100 years ago. That's all we've got time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items as well as podcasts are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. We leave you tonight with some music. Last November, Mike Hanrahan joined us in studio for a programme on the music of the Irish War of Independence. To play us out, we're going to hear Mike's rendition of Shanna Golden by the late Kerry songwriter Sean McCarthy. Our researcher is Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
From the mountain are calling soft to me. Smell of scented heather brings bitter memories. A wild and lonely eagle in that summer sky flies high o'er Shanna Golden, where my love Willie lies. I met him in the winter time when snow was on the ground. The Irish hills were peaceful then, love was all around. Scarcely 20 years old, a young man in his prime. We were married, darling Willie, by the eve of Christmas time. Remember, Willie, we walked that moonlit road. I held you in my arms, love, and never let you go. Our hands, they were entwined, my love, all in the pale moonlight. By the fields of Shanna Golden, on a lonely winter's night. To arms, love, the heather was aflame. Down from the silent mountain, that Saxon stranger came. I held you in my arms, my love, my young heart wild with fear. In the fields of Shanna Golden, in the springtime of the year.
Radio 1.